Mason v. Thomas O. Mulligan. Attorney Dean Dietrich representing Mulligan, 25 units. Attorney Siebold representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation, 30 minutes. And then Attorney Dietrich, you know you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Would you please proceed, counsel?
Mr. Dietrich, before you begin, we have next to our chairs here an amplifier. I have a hearing problem, and the amplifier is not working today. So anyone who's speaking into the microphone and wants to be heard by me should speak up boldly.
Counsel.
I certainly will do so, Justice Prosser, and I have been told that that's typically not a problem for me, but I will certainly speak up.
Before you proceed, counsel, we have three empty chairs here.
Yes.
Justice Gableman is not in the building, and he will listen to the oral argument and participate. Justice Bradley is not in the building, but she is not participating at all, as you very well know, since her husband is a member of the Rita Ware Law Firm, which you are a member of also. And Justice Ziegler is not in the building and said she wasn't participating today, but it's not clear to me whether that's a final word on the whole case or just that she's not participating today. So, well, that's the information I'm giving you. Okay?
Yes. Thank you, Chief Justice. Chief Justice and members of the court, my name is Dean Dietrich, and I am here today with the respondent in this case, Thomas Mulligan. Thomas Mulligan has been in the practice of law for 43 years and comes here today because we believe it is very important for this court to hear our position regarding this case, because our view is that this case is very different than what is presented in the referee report. This is a case of a lawyer that's been in the practice of law for 43 years. This is a case of a lawyer who has provided services in a small community in northwestern Wisconsin for many of those years. This is a case where there has been a great deal of testimony provided about the handling of trust account records and about the handling of funds. But this is not a case that this court has seen in other settings where the allegations of the complaint brought by OLR are that an attorney took money from a client and used it for personal gain. This is not a case like the case relied upon by the referee, the Voss case. This is not a case like Attorney Voss, who served as a fiduciary for a guardian. And while serving in that capacity, took monies from the guardian, used those monies for other purposes, and told the court every year that there was less than $1,000 in the account of that ward. When it was finally investigated and discovered, he had absconded with $47,000. He lied to the court regarding what was the balance in those accounts and how those funds were used. That's not the case that's before you for consideration. Our position to the court is that the discipline proposed by the referee is inappropriate and unwarranted in this case. Our view is that this case involves a failure to maintain some proper records for the trust account in Attorney Mulligan's practice. This case involves a failure to give a notice of engagement in a case where the client had been represented by another attorney for a number of months and the matter was transferred to Attorney Mulligan for the purpose of continuing the representation because the former client or the former attorney became a judge. And this is a case where there was monies put into the trust account of the law office of Tom Mulligan. But when those monies were put into the account, there were personal monies put into that account, and payments were made based upon Mr. Mulligan's review and understanding of the monies that had been put into the account by him, acknowledging it to be inappropriate, putting it into the account, and then using trust account checks to pay for personal obligations or for things like tax returns. This is not a case, as relied upon by the referee, where somebody breached their fiduciary duties and lied to the court. We also questioned the findings from the referee because the record shows that the referee decided to investigate and ask for records from the State Bar of Wisconsin that had not been produced as part of the proceedings. This court has, in prior cases, addressed allegations of a lawyer failing to properly complete a trust account certification on a State Bar dues statement. There is nothing in the record of the hearing relating to that. Nothing whatsoever. In the recommendations from the referee, for the first time, we see the trust account certifications from the State Bar of Wisconsin, never produced by OLR in the proceedings.
So the referee relied on information outside of the record?
It is attached to the recommendations. I believe that it is part of a effort to make this case seem to fit like the Voss case.
No, but what I'm trying to get to, maybe I just misheard what you said, that the referee independently got records from the State Bar.
That's correct.
Okay. And those were not records that the prosecutor got and were presented to your client as part of the hearing.
That's correct.
So he independently created facts after the hearing was closed.
That's correct.
Okay. Wow.
The records he got, Mr. Diedrich, as I understand it, were the yearly certifications required by the State Bar in regard to whether or not your trust account is current, is being used, is appropriate. Is that what we're talking about?
That is what we're talking about, Justice Crooks. And the certification indicates that the trust account was administered pursuant to the requirements of the rule. In this particular case, there was not a certification signed by Attorney Mulligan, but none of that was included as part of the hearing.
But do you disagree that the referee could take judicial notice of those certifications?
Your Honor, I have two concerns about the notion of judicial notice. The first one is judicial notice is designed to be used for a judge to take recognition of. It's more than just, quote, known facts, but typically what it is used for is to take notice of state statutes that would apply or administrative rulings that would apply. That's not what was done here. Secondly, I do not think it's common under the theory of judicial notice to go out and acquire documents, to actually ask for copies of documents, and then make those part of the referee's record. I don't think that's the function and purpose of.
Found it online?
Pardon me?
Could he have found it online?
No, Chief Justice, my understanding is he made contacted the State Bar, and asked that those records be sent to him.
This says 902 deals with, Chapter 902 deals with judicial notice, right?
Right.
And the regular rules apply, right? So 902 would apply.
Yes, that's correct, Chief Justice.
So the judicially noticed facts must be one not subject to reasonable dispute in that it is any of the following. A fact generally known under A, B, a fact capable of accurate and ready determination by resort to sources whose accuracy cannot reasonably be questioned. Does it fall under 90201 to B?
I submit, Chief Justice, that it does not, because this is not taking notice of principles or statutes or administrative rules. This is gathering new evidence.
Mr. Diedrich, that isn't what this rule says. It says that you can take judicial notice of a fact capable of accurate and ready determination by resort to sources whose accuracy can't be questioned. So if he filed something with the state bar, why isn't that a fact that you can take notice of? No one's challenging its accuracy. A judge or court may take judicial notice whether requested or not. A judge or court shall take notice if requested by a party. Now, 5 says a party is entitled upon timely request to an opportunity to be heard as to the propriety of taking judicial notice and the tenor of the matter noticed. Did you ever go back to the referee and object?
I did not, Your Honor, because the referee filed the report with this court, and the next step for me in this process is today to make the appeal before the court.
Sub 5 says in the absence of prior notification, the request may be made after judicial notice has been taken.
But Justice, I did not know that judicial notice was being taken until the report came out.
I understand that, but isn't there a way of asking for a referee to reconsider that you object to the findings because you object to the conclusion of law because you object to judicial notice because?
Within the procedures of the Office of Lawyer Regulation and the hearing process, there is no such procedure, Chief Justice, and we are dealing with a notion of fundamental fairness. And the fundamental fairness here is lost because the information is put into the record. It is weighed by the referee. It is part of the referee's recommendation. And the first time we have any knowledge of that is upon receipt of the referee's recommendation filed with this court, not sent ahead of time to counsel.
Shall we send this back to the referee?
Well, I think that a proper review of the record and what we are dealing with here and the reliances that are made by the referee on certain case law that I think he tried to make part of this case, which is not part of this case, would allow this court to make a decision that I think is fair and appropriate under the standards applied by the court. An option, Chief Justice, would be, of course, a remanding of the case back to the referee. Again, I'm not aware of that being a described process, but certainly within the power of the court.
Now, we've sent things back to the referee when we didn't think the referee did something or covered something or should have covered something. Now, I want to just check something else. Did Mr. Mulligan concede that he committed 7 of the 8 charged counts?
Excuse me?
Did Mr. Mulligan concede that he committed 7 of the 8 charged accounts?
Chief Justice, Attorney Mulligan did not concede to the fact that he violated the rules. He did concede, and the facts are there, that he did write some checks out of the trust account to cash. He did concede that there were personal monies put into the trust account and were used to pay for private bills such as taxes and things of that nature. I submit, Justices, that that's the type of violation that warrants a direction to attend the trust account school, not a 1.5-year suspension of a lawyer's license. One of the goals of this whole process is education of the lawyer. This is not a case where we need to impose some level of sanction to teach other lawyers not to steal money, because this is not a stealing money case. This is an improper records case, and the primary goal of the court should be to make sure Attorney Mulligan understands how his law office should be run. This is not a case that you typically see, as suggested in Voss, where a lawyer is hiding money and using it for his own benefit. We also believe...
So if I understand what you're saying, the violations of which he's charged are that he had an account that it was his trust account, but he basically used it as a personal account, too.
Not for everything, Justice. Not for everything. It was his lawyer business account. I'm sorry, his lawyer trust account. I'm going to use those words because those are the ones I think are most descriptive. It was his law office trust account. There were several instances where he put personal money that he had gotten from either settlements of some, not client suits, personal suits, or money put aside to pay for his personal income taxes or his children's income taxes. He didn't put all of his money into the law office trust account. It were select monies that he put in with a rationale for them.
So he put them in to kind of set it aside so it would be there when he needed it?
That's correct. That's correct, Justice.
Instead of opening up another account that he put special monies in if he needed to save up for something.
That's correct. And at times as well, there were fees that he earned that had been put into the trust account, and he had not taken those out. So he viewed those as being there as well for those special occurrences.
So if someone paid him an advance fee of $5,000, when he earned it, he didn't necessarily take it out right away?
That's correct. Now, not in not all cases, but in many cases, yes.
Did he have a separate business account for running his business?
Yes, he did. He had
a separate
law firm business account.
And did he have a separate personal account, either his own or he and his wife, to use together?
I think he had a personal checking account that his wife had and that they managed separately, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Dietrich, weren't there allegations here, charges here, that what he did in some instances was take money that should have gone into the trust account and rather put it into his business account? And did not handle it as the trust account rules provide.
There are two allegations of that nature, Justice Crooks, but I want to parse them and make it very clear. The first allegation is at the time that he continued this representation, he took over the representation from another attorney because that attorney got elected to judge, he received a standard fee, a flat fee, and he put that into his business account. What is alleged there is the failure to communicate to the client who was in jail, and he met with the client's father. What is alleged there is a failure to communicate what's going to happen with that fee. I think this court understands very well the confusion that we've had across the state regarding, quote, retainer fees. And we've tried to fix that, and we've tried to write articles to make that clear, and that still continues to be an area of confusion. In the second case, again, there was a taking of a fee for a divorce matter and a failure to provide, it was put into the business account, and a failure to provide the proper notices that are to be given as that the money's going to go into the business account, and if there's a dispute about fees, it'll be subject to an arbitration proceeding, which are the requirements under the trust account rule, happened on one occasion. And I would point out to the court that there are no clients here that have said that they are not, that their money isn't been given to them, that they haven't received their money. There is nothing here from particular clients saying, I didn't receive the money that was due and owing to me. The third allegation is the client agreed that he was to take what had been put into his trust account as a fee of $5,000. Client agrees, yes, you can take that money, except take $500 and put it in the account for use by the client. So $4,500 was fees that the client agreed to. $500 was to go to the client for purposes of their account in jail. What OLR is claiming, well, he took the $5,000 out, he held on to the $500 until he could find out what jail to put it in. Olar's claiming that was that he shouldn't have taken that $500 out. Again, we're dealing with a very, I think the record shows, a very sophisticated criminal defense matter. A lot of claims in this. And by the way, I would offer to the court, one of the issues that was raised by the referee was Attorney Mulligan did not provide proper representation to this criminal defendant. And therefore, there should be restitution given to this particular client in the amount of $7,500. I quote to you from Exhibit 28 in this record, on page 2, this is the brief submitted by OLR after the hearing. I quote to you, however, whether Mulligan did or did not earn his fees is irrelevant to the counts before the referee. That's what was stated by OLR. In fact, the referee went into exhaustive discussion about that representation and found that he didn't like the representation and found there should be restitution of fees, which was never pled for or asked for by the Office of Lawyer Regulation. I submit to you that the referee has tried to pigeonhole this case into the Voss case. And having personally served and continue to serve as the guardian of a ward responsible for an account, that's a very different responsibility when you are the person designated to determine how this money is to be spent for a ward that's under your jurisdiction.
So are you saying OLR never asked that $7,500 of restitution be paid to the client?
That is correct, Your Honor, Your Justice.
All right. But the referee saw that issue differently.
Well, the referee, I guess I have to say yes, Justice, the referee saw it differently. I'm not sure I understand how you can see it differently when it was not pled and not part of the proceedings.
Okay.
Mr. Diedrich, wasn't the referee especially concerned because there was a document that was made part of this record that was prepared apparently after services had been completed, and the referee felt that that document had a number of inaccuracies, a number of so-called services that were not provided, and that he felt there was dishonesty on the part of your client based on the submission of that document?
I would first state, Justice Crooks, that the referee did not say that it was dishonesty which supported a 20:8.4C complaint. In fact, it's not alleged. There was no amending of anything. And we submit that none of this case warrants a finding of misconduct under 20:8.4C. We would offer to you, Justice Crooks, number one, the fact that the referee went to CCAP to look at the information. Now, I might offer that might be a proper use of judicial notice in that type of a circumstance. But in addition, the information was offered after the representation because it was a flat fee representation, and flat fee representations typically you do not keep contemporaneous time records, so it was put together after the fact, so we had some ability to show to the referee the services that were provided to this particular individual. There was nothing there that suggests that we were in any way hiding things or in any way lying about things. It was put together to the best of our abilities from the file record, and there were dates that were different. There were some things omitted that the referee thought should have been in that report. Again, I acknowledge the right to look at that, but to now conclude because of that we're dealing with an 8.4C violation is not a proper connection. I would finally submit to this court that what we are dealing with here is a situation where a lawyer of many years maybe not as sophisticated as some of the younger lawyers today in the world of technology, was doing everything he thought was best in what he had been doing in the form of trying to manage his office. This is not a case of a lawyer stealing money from a client. This is not the case of a lawyer lying to the court about how much money should be in an account that that lawyer manages on behalf of another party. We submit to you that the appropriate discipline, and that this court must look at all of the facts in this proceeding, that the appropriate discipline should be some form of a reprimand and a direction that this lawyer go to the trust account school, which is what has been done in other cases, and which is what we have cited to in some of the cases that we have submitted with our brief. This is not a case like the Voss case. And the referee has said this fits into all the umbrellas of the Voss case. And I submit to you it does not, and I submit to you that the Voss case is not a proper basis for this court to consider discipline. What this is about is the handling of funds from a record-keeping perspective, and what the purpose of the discipline should be is that proper education be given to Attorney Mulligan so he clearly understands what his responsibilities are. Changes he has testified to, the changes he made in his law office operation, but certainly an understanding of the trust account rule as viewed by the Office of Lawyer Regulation would be an appropriate direction from this court.
And you're saying no client was hurt. No client should get restitution.
There has been no client claiming that they have been hurt. Well, the referee says there wasn't sufficient representation. We submit to you, if you look at the record and look at the time spent, that there clearly was sufficient representation, and the amount of counts that were dismissed in the final settlement of that criminal representation clearly shows the effort that was undertaken by Attorney Mulligan to represent that client. Thank you.
Attorney Dietrich.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Abramson, Justice Rosenzweig, Justice Crooks, Justice Prosser, and Justice Gableman. My name is Gregory Seibold. I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation in this case. And I think the starting point for the Court should be the fact that Mr. Mulligan admitted the facts underlying essentially all of the counts in this matter. Now, he quibbles with one, which I'll get to, but he admits he failed to enter into a written fee agreement with Richard Wiley under circumstances where he should have under the rules. He admits that he failed to deposit Richard Wiley's first unearned advanced fee payment of $5,000 into his trust account, instead depositing it into his business account. He admits he transferred $500 of Richard Wiley's money from his trust account to his business account. He admits he failed to deposit Andrea Brown's $1,750 advanced fee payment into his trust account, opting instead to deposit it into his business account under circumstances where he should have. He admits he deposited personal funds into his trust account over a period of years, four that we know of, totaling at least $45,000. He admits he withdrew funds from that same trust account over that four-year period for personal expenditures totaling approximately $54,000. He admits he didn't keep a transaction record, client ledgers, or reconciliation reports during that entire time period. Now, he disputes he made cash disbursements from his trust account for personal expenditures in an amount greater than his deposit of personal funds, but he couldn't back up his assertion at hearing or in post-hearing argument with any sort of an accounting. We presented Travis Stearns, the investigator at the Office of Lawyer Regulation. We presented his accounting with a starting point of $2,774. We showed all of the deposits for personal expenditures that were made. We showed all of the withdrawals for personal expenditures that were made over this four-year period. And the end result was that there was a $9,088 difference.
Did you take into account fees that he had earned that just had not isolated them from an advance payment or a retainer of any type?
Mr. Stearns took into account every transaction in the trust account and the information that was requested of Mr. Mulligan and provided by Mr. Mulligan as to the purpose of the transaction. And based upon that information, his characterization of an item as personal or business, Mr. Stearns was able to calculate that $9,088 more of personal funds were withdrawn over that period of time than were deposited over that period.
Yeah, what I'm trying to get at with my question is your use of the term personal funds.
Sure.
Okay. And I understand how you've characterized those monies that he put in that were his own monies, not associated with any work for a client. What I'm wondering about is when he had an advance payment from a client but had not yet taken the money out of the trust account and put it in his business account, did you look for those kinds of transactions?
Well, I guess the short answer is sure. If money is an unearned fee and put into the trust account,
Right, I got that. But I'm saying when it's earned and it still hasn't been taken.
Well, it really begs the question of, well, how do we know if it's earned or not?
Well, I suppose you'd have to look at the bills that he sent out to the clients. I mean, it's been so long since I practiced law.
Sure.
I don't have a current knowledge, but I know when I was in practice, we would send monthly bills out to a client, even though we had money in the account, so the client could say yes or no, or that looks fine or doesn't look fine. You know, so there was always some reason, and our business manager took care of when it got moved, so I never had to really deal with that when I was in a larger firm. Though when I started, I was by myself. I can't remember at all what in the world happened. I know we had to do an accounting, just like, well, probably not as particularized as now because we've gotten more specific with our trust account rules. But I guess what I was trying to figure out is if he's practicing, he sends a bill out to a client, but he's got a retainer in his account. The client is not disapproving the bill, and that's fine. But because he's busy with other work, he just doesn't get around to withdrawing the money from the trust account until some other time later. Were those kinds of transactions there? I guess that's the first question. And number two, did you take into that account when you said he was $9,000 short, essentially?
Sure. Thank you, Justice. I think the short answer to that is we can't tell because accurate records were not kept.
He didn't send a bill out to a client that he had a retainer on saying, this month I did A, B, and C, and I spent this amount of money, and then the next month I did A, B, and C, and I spent this amount of money. He didn't send that kind of stuff out?
Well, if he did, he did not submit it to OLR as part of the investigation, and he did not admit it at hearing.
Okay.
And if you'll bear with me for a second, the starting point of Mr. Stearns' analysis had a balance in the trust account of $2,774, mm-hmm. right? And because we had to come up with a starting point to do the analysis, and it obviously wasn't a zero balance because it was an existing account. So we really don't know what that $2,774 was comprised of. Could be client money, could be personal money. Okay. So what we did was said to the referee, we presented the evidence, and I argued that if we give Mr. Mulligan the benefit of the doubt and say it's all client money, then you subtract the $9,088 or the $2,774 from the $9,088, you have $6,900 roughly that is still personal money. Now, at hearing, Mr. Mulligan testified that there were some transaction amounts that that he says were earned fees in an anecdotal sort of fashion in an attempt to justify a $7,000 withdrawal that he made in 2011. But it was all anecdotal, all based upon Mr. Mulligan's own self-serving testimony, and in fact his legal assistant, or his office assistant, who testified at the hearing, when I asked her, what's your basis for your testimony that this was an earned fee? In every instance, it was because Mr. Mulligan said so, not based upon any contemporaneous transactions of showing bills sent, withdrawal from the trust account, contemporaneous deposit into the business account, which is what you would expect to see. So we have this a clear accounting. As I said several times in this case, the numbers don't lie. That shows that he took out more money in personal money than he deposited into the trust account. That is conversion. It is. They may want to say it's not, but it is. And just as importantly, Mr. Mulligan says, I choose not to believe you. I choose not to believe Mr. Stern's testimony. Well, why not? How can you substantiate this difference? And he said, essentially, I've told you what I can. So on the one hand, and this does go to the issue of an appropriate sanction, on the one hand, he says, I don't believe you. And on the other hand, he cannot provide any rational reason why his view of things should be believed. So we have essentially an admission of all of the facts, except for the accounting, and we have no facts contrary to the accounting provided by Mr. Stern in this case. Now, the other, I think, probably the most significant argument made by the respondent in this case is that there's no evidence of intentional wrongdoing, that this is really a few technical violations that can be cured by some education. Well, that's not really the case, because, first of all, when we get past all the technical violations that went on for a period of 4 years that we were able to track, it's not part of the record, and I can speculate that it was going on longer before that, but for at least 4 years for part of the record, there was a chronic lack of proper accounting and a chronic use of the trust account for personal purposes. Now, Mr. Mulligan's justification for doing that was that he wanted someplace other than his personal account to park this money because it was safer. He testified that he did this as a safety move. I'm referring to R22, which is the transcript, page 160 and 168. It's in my brief on appeal at page 4. Based upon the fact that he had gotten bitten so hard in the past. And what he talked about was how he had a business partner who had taken some money of his, and another time he was defrauded by a banker. So the idea, if Mr. Mulligan is to be believed, is that he put his money in the trust account to protect it from people who may potentially do him wrong in the future. Well, the only implicit justification for doing that is that somehow the trust account is going to protect that money. So fast forward into the future, somebody tries to get at that money. Mr. Mulligan, because he was cautious on the front end, says, you can't get at that money because it's trust account money. Well, the implicit statement there is it's client trust account money, but it's not. It's personal money. So it's a misrepresentation.
Oh, did any client lose money on this?
We are not aware of any client that made a claim that they personally lost money by Mr. Mulligan's activities.
Any of your records show that a client lost money? And if not, where is this restitution issue?
There's nothing in the record that indicates that any particular client was deprived of trust account funds. The restitution issue, and admittedly, OLR did not seek restitution because under the factors, the rules that OLR chooses to go by to determine whether to seek restitution, we couldn't reasonably come up with a number that Mr. Mulligan didn't earn. Now, the referee obviously disagreed, and what the referee did essentially was he looked at the itemization that was provided by Mr. Mulligan, and he looked at the CCAP records also provided as an exhibit in this case by Mr. Mulligan, and he there was questioning on the itemization at the hearing, and the referee looked at those two exhibits, and he said, this itemization is a complete fabrication. He is the arbiter of credibility. He looked at it and said, I choose not to believe anything you put down here. And I think he was entitled to do that if that was his finding based upon the not only the documentary evidence but the testimony and his impression of Mr. Mulligan and the testimony at trial. So he said, this itemization is a complete fabrication, so therefore, how can we really determine what benefit you provided to Mr. Wiley?
Do you know what paragraph he got into the stuff with CCAP, comparing his time records to CCAP?
The referee?
Yeah, the referee.
It was toward the end. Don't have the page.
That's okay. I can keep looking. I have it right here in front of me, too.
Okay. I just didn't apologize. I don't have that right at the forefront. But he then went to CCAP, again, an exhibit offered and admitted by Mr. Mulligan in this case, and he said he didn't do anything, really, hardly anything. You didn't make motions that you would expect to find in a criminal case, and he discusses that in his decision. And I think what the referee did then was he used his best judgment to put a value on what he felt the service was that was provided by Mr. Mulligan, and based upon that judgment, he essentially there was $9,500 that was paid in total by Mr. Wiley. And I think the referee made the determination that based on what he could see that was done, based on the CCAP records, that he maybe earned a couple thousand dollars, and therefore the rest should be returned as restitution. We did not ask for it. Obviously, the court is the decision maker on that issue, but I do not think that the referee was out of line in making that decision because
What, during the course of the hearing, what was presented, I found what I was looking for now in the referee's report. And during the course of the hearing, what was presented in regard to restitution?
Nothing. Because we did not seek restitution. So we did not submit any.
Okay. So what he did is he took an exhibit that purported to, a couple exhibits, I guess, that purported to show time spent on client matters, compared it with CCAP, and said, oh, well, CCAP printout shows that there wasn't any reference in there to any case involving Mr. Wiley on August 13th, yet he billed him for some time on August 13th. Is that the kind of thing that you mean?
Right, and actually, thank you for pointing that out, because he did two things. One, he said, I look at CCAP, and there's no and I look at the time itemization, there's no corresponding entry in CCAP to substantiate what he claims he did in his itemization. And likewise, he looked at CCAP, and he said, I don't see where you did things that should have been done in a case like this, filed motions, et cetera. So he looked at it in both directions. And
he looked at CCAP and said the guy didn't adequately that the attorney didn't adequately prepare for what he said he was going to do there, even if there was a hearing. So he discounted his records. And he also looked at CCAP and said, well, there wasn't a hearing on that date involving this particular person, so the charges that you made were not proper. Am I understanding what you're saying?
Yes, but I think that he also, Referee Kinney was a sitting judge, and so he is very familiar, I think, with what you would expect to see in criminal matters such as this.
Sure.
I do not practice in criminal matters much, and so therefore I'm not very authoritative on saying what you would expect to see in that particular case to be, you know, filed.
And when you say expect to see,
or whatever,
you would expect to see in a timesheet, if you're going in a criminal matter for a particular hearing, that A, B, and C would have been done, that the lawyer would have done that kind of work? Is that
or on CCAP, you would have seen that a particular motion was filed.
Okay, yeah.
And,
okay.
And you don't see that.
And you don't see it. Okay, all right, good. Thank you very much.
Sure. The other thing is that I think that the referee approached this also from the viewpoint of responding to what Mr. Mulligan's position was in the case. Again, Mr. Mulligan's position was, you know, these are a bunch of technical matters. And, by the way, I provided great representation to these individuals, and that should count for something. And he also claimed, in 2011, I sought counsel from another lawyer, and I reformed my trust account practices. And so, therefore, take that into account and don't sanction me as severely as you might otherwise. Well, the referee, I think, you know, faced with those arguments that were explicitly made at hearing and subsequently by Mr. Mulligan, decided to look at the WIS test certificates and CCAP and the itemizations.
Counsel?
Chief Justice?
What about this idea that Mr. Diedrich said about taking judicial notice of matters outside the record and relying on them? These are the State Bar certifications. What's your view on that?
My view, essentially, is that as a general matter, I think that OLR does not suggest and does not encourage the idea that referees ought to go off on their own fact-finding expeditions and supplement the record on their own in substantial ways on a regular basis. In this particular instance, I actually don't think it was inappropriate, and that's for several reasons. First of all, as the court pointed out, under the rule, the question isn't, is it some type of narrow disciplinary proceeding that was looked at? It's essentially any fact that has reliability that is in the public domain. I'm paraphrasing, of course. And this was exactly one of those types of information. And it's not as if Mr. Mulligan is saying, you took judicial notice of something that really is not credible. It's a specious opinion or unreliable fact. It is Mr. Mulligan's own representation. How can he dispute the referee taking judicial notice of his own sworn statement to the bar? And on top of that, It really goes to the issue of a sanction, not to the elements of any particular count. So the quote that Mr. Dietrich so ably pointed out in my brief is accurate, that whether or not, well, I forget the quote exactly, but the bottom line is the issue of the WISTAF certificate does not go to the elements of any of the claims, but it does go to Mr. Mulligan's assertion again throughout these proceedings that he reformed his trust account practices, and therefore he's not worthy of greater sanction. Well, the public record, based on his own statements, shows that that's not the case. And so in those limited circumstances, I think it's appropriate, but I'm certainly not here to argue that referees ought to be able to go off on their own fact-finding missions. The one point I do want to make also is that this idea that Mr. Mulligan's activities were essentially innocent, mistaken activities, lack of oversight, but that there was no intent on his part. And perhaps I made this point already now that I think about it. The misrepresentation that occurred as a result of his use of his trust account for the purposes that he said to essentially shelter personal monies from business associates is, in fact, a misrepresentation under 20:1.0 sub H, I believe it is. Misrepresentation includes communications made with reckless disregard of the true facts. Well, when you put money into a trust account to try and cloak them in some kind of protection with the idea that they are client trust monies when, in fact, they're personal monies, is, at very least, a reckless use of the trust account. And there is, again, the implicit representation there, misrepresentation, that the funds in the account are client monies when they are not. And that's reckless, and that's a violation of 8.4 sub C.
Counsel, what I heard from Attorney Diedrich was, in effect, okay, this trust account was not kept properly. It was commingling of personal funds and trust account funds. Indeed, funds in the trust account were taken out in the large sums for personal matters that exceeded what was in the trust account. That, as far as you can tell, no client was short money. They may have gotten paid late, but no one was short money. And Dean Diedrich presents a case that his client did not do right under the trust account rules. No one was hurt. Therefore, 18 months looks outrageous for what Mr. Diedrich, and I'm putting words into Mr. Diedrich's mouth, view as technical, although this is not. He did say technical violations. And 18 months is an educational measure to not do technical flaws is too much. How do you respond to that? And he has two violations previously, but as I read them, they really don't present the same kind of issues that this case does. It presents issues of failing to refund unearned fees, failing to communicate with clients, failing to refund advance payment in 2005, you get 97, 2005, then in 2009, a public reprimand for not obtaining trial transcripts, failing to consult with the client. So the different kinds of offenses for, although progressive discipline still makes sense. But, you know, if I had three prior trust account violations, it would get more of my attention for the purposes of discipline in this case. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm driving at?
I think I do, Chief Justice. And my response would be a twofold, I guess, factual and somewhat based upon precedent. First of all, these innocent mistakes took place over a four-year period. This wasn't simply a one-time client issue, and the court has sought, seen fit to give two-year suspensions in cases that involve, you know, overt stealing, for lack of a better word, where the amounts are significant. Evans and Edgar, for example. You don't have that here, but what you have is over a four-year period involving numerous clients, a failure to handle their own money properly, and that put that client money at risk. And so it wasn't a limited thing. It was a chronic, ongoing thing. Number two, Mr. Mulligan, at hearing with regard to the question of fee agreements and whether he needed to have a proper advanced fee agreement under 20:1.15 in order to take money and put it in his business account rather than his trust account, said, I think I ought to be able to contract with my clients with regard to how I'm going to handle advance fees in whatever way I choose. That doesn't indicate that Mr. Mulligan appreciates the gravity of what has happened. And one of the principal factors that the court needs to look at is impressing upon the attorney the gravity of it and the wrongfulness of the conduct. And, you know, in some sense, I understand it. And Mr. Mulligan's been practicing for a long time, admittedly, and he's, I think, entrenched in his ways. It's reasonable to understand that. But we are all required to follow the rules and conform our conduct to the rules, even if it means changing our ways. And I certainly want to be careful and not offend, but I think Mr. Mulligan does not want to do that. He's been doing it his way for so long that he doesn't really want to change, and he doesn't, based on his testimony, show that he is inclined to do that. So I think the sanction is appropriate based upon that. Looking at precedent, the Voss case, I think the Voss case is appropriate precedent. Mr. Dietrich pointed out that Mr. Voss was, and by the way, my light is red. Could I have permission to just finish this response? Mr. Dietrich pointed out that Mr. Voss had responsibility for a fiduciary account. So did Mr. Mulligan. A trust account is a fiduciary account. Number two, Mr. Voss mishandled that fiduciary account for numerous years. I think it was like 18 years or something like that. And the total amount that Mr. Voss ended up not being able to account for was like $47,000. Well, here it wasn't 18 years, but it was 4 years. And there may not have been any provable loss to a particular client, but we're not talking a few hundred dollars over a period of 4 years. We're talking in the neighborhood of $50,000 over a period of 4 years. And during that entire time period, people were at risk. Their money was at risk. I do agree, Chief Justice, that Mr. Mulligan's prior public and private reprimands do not involve the same type of conduct, and that is a factor that you'll have to look at. But on balance, I do think that that Voss and Edgar and Evans and Bolt and the facts in this case warrant at least the 18-month suspension. I'm sorry.
What did the OLR ask for in terms of a sanction, discipline?
2 years. And the referee found 18
gave
months.
A year and a half.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Diedrich?
Attorney Voss, in the Voss matter, lied to the court for a number of years when he put in his annual statement about what monies should be in that account. Attorney Voss failed to cooperate with the Office of Lawyer Regulation, gave no response at all when the Office of Lawyer Regulation conducted an investigation. Attorney Mulligan is being accused of wrongdoing because we stipulated to facts. We didn't stipulate to violations, but we didn't prove, we stipulated to facts. The stipulation in the record shows that, as I explained in my first argument, we admitted that certain things were not done properly. That shouldn't penalize Attorney Mulligan. This is not like the Voss case.
How did the referee use? I just went looked back at those stipulations that he got from the on the trust account. How did the referee use those? You point out that Attorney Voss lied to the court by false certifications. Are Attorney Mulligan's certifications correct?
If I recall correctly, the record, there is nothing signed on those particular statements, which there should have been something signed, but there was nothing signed, if I recall the record correctly. Oh,
okay, well, maybe I was looking at something else. I thought I had them in front of me. Why weren't they signed?
I think, Chief Justice, I think we're here with a case where office practices could be better. We all can do better.
Okay.
The representation of Wiley involved 80-plus felonies. The results of that representation was a good result for that particular client. That's the point we made at hearing. That's the point we make here today. The fact that there aren't motions filed according to what the referee felt there should be depends upon how the case is administered, depends upon what deals are being struck between the attorney and the prosecuting attorney. That's why we submit that the OLR correctly stated whether Mulligan did or did not earn his fees is irrelevant to the counts before the referee. The record shows you there was communication in regards to Wiley. There was an agreement signed by Wiley that, yes, you can take this $4,500, and the $500 goes to the client. There is signed documentation. It's not like everything is completely non-existent. There is an agreement regarding the fees for Attorney Brown. I'm sorry, for Client Brown. OLR is not happy with how that is written. But there are documents created. I don't want the court to leave today without understanding that documents were created, that there was that communication. I submit to the court. I will try and use what I think are more appropriate words. When you are dealing with cases like this, the consideration of the court is, does the punishment fit the conduct? Oftentimes those words are used in a little more spicier way, but that's the issue before this court. And I submit to you, when you look at the record that was stipulated to, when you look at the fact we're arguing about whether $500 should have stayed into the trust account, and a check written from the trust account instead of from the lawyer's business account. The check got to the client. It was put into the account for the client to use while in prison. the proposed punishment does not fit the conduct that is alleged. Oh, but wait a minute. We could go look at now all the additional things that are brought to the table by the referee.
Is there any way of, to me it looks like this is how he's been doing business. So that's why he's got so many violations. This is how he does business. And that's why, he may not like to follow the rules and he hasn't been particular about doing so. Is there any way of having someone check on how he's running his shop, so to speak, so that we don't have this, that he's got to make the changes that are required?
Absolutely, Justice Rogan-Sack. One way for that, as I have suggested, is attendance at the trust account school. But
well,
another way...
They won't, I mean, I'm sure he reads the rules, but if he goes to trust account school and he doesn't feel like following them, I don't see why there's any difference that's going
well,
to occur.
Well, in fact, beyond that, there have been orders by this court to require that the trust account records be submitted on an annual basis to the Office of Lawyer Regulation for review. In addition, there certainly could be, I think from this court, a direction that someone review the business practices, the office practices of Attorney Mulligan, perhaps his counsel, and give some sort of review of how are things being handled and is this being handled properly. But I know for a fact the court has, in other instances, ordered that the trust account records be submitted to OLR on an annual basis for review.
Okay. Thank you.
I see that I have reached the red light. I will answer any other questions if you wish.
You said there were some 80 offenses involving Mr. Wiley?
There were two different counties. So you've got to be careful when you review the record that there were approximately 80 different counts brought against him. There was first an initial set. And while he was being prosecuted, certain other things happened.
And I thought you said that Attorney Mulligan achieved a good result for the client. True?
Based upon 80 felonies, yes.
And what was the result?
There was some imprisonment, but it was limited imprisonment. And a number of counts were dropped.
How much imprisonment?
I'm sorry, Justice, I don't recall the specifics of that. I can check if you want, but I don't recall.
But there was a plea bargain?
Yes. Yes.
Why is there restitution then? What is the argument that there wasn't adequate representation?
Justice Prosser, I apologize, but I cannot answer that question because I do not understand why there is a suggestion for restitution. It was never requested by OLR. There has never been a complaint brought by Mr. Wiley that he did not receive proper representation. And, quote, whether Mulligan did it or not earn his fees is irrelevant to the counts. I apologize, but I cannot answer that question.
Well, your brief seems to indicate that it doesn't calculate. That, if I'm reading it right, that the phone calls plus the billable hours come up to 2,500, not 7,500, and that you just can't get to those numbers. Is that your...
And Chief Justice, regardless of what type of practice you are in, if you don't keep your records contemporaneously when the event happens, your records are not going to be as accurate as they should be. And again, this was provided in order to show the referee that there was success in this representation.
Any further questions? Hearing none, I want to thank Mr. Diedrich and Mr. Siebold for coming today, and Mr. Mulligan. These cases are always very difficult for the court, and we appreciate the briefs and the arguments today. This concludes our hearing on 2013 AP 2742D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Thomas O. Mulligan. The court will convene in the conference room immediately, please.